7. Like this morning, it's been a couple of weeks since I've been here. Last week, Brother Gip preached, in the week before, I actually spoke from Luke in the evening service, because I spoke from 2 Samuel in the morning service. Things got jumbled around. We had several lost people here, band members that were helping out with the concert last Sunday night, or the send-off for Mike and Dave. And so I think it'd be worthwhile to kind of get caught up in where we are in context again. I don't mean to overdo it, but by the same token, I think if we just jumped into the new material, it would be out of place in all of our minds, especially those that weren't here last time. And 1 Corinthians chapter 7, once again, where it's located in the book, it comes after a couple of things. The first four chapters, we could title those dissensions in the church, and we could title chapter 5 and 6 disorders in the church. And when we get to chapter 7, I've given that the title of domestic guidelines for the church, because it deals with issues concerning husband and wife. And again, there's a very natural flow of the ideas and the reasoning from chapter 5 and chapter 6. The things he'd recently been talking about in the epistle were going to law and giving in to lust. That's in chapter 5 and chapter 6. Those two things, going to law and giving in to lust. Now again, the solution to lust is not marriage. Because a person who's full of lust can get married and still be full of lust. They may have one outlet for it, but the problem isn't biological. The problem is spiritual. And as a matter of fact, the real solution to lust is temperance and spirit filling. And again, the order of Paul's argument seems to be, if you take it all together and look at all the things that he's been talking about all in through there, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, is that there seem to be two things that'll get a Christian into civil court. One of them is greed, and the other one is lust. And greed will get you into civil court for different reasons, but lust always seems to be tied in here with Christians being in court. And divorce is the number one leading reason why Christians find themselves in court. And so if Christians are in court in chapter 6, then what is the number one reason why the Christians are there? If that's divorce, then that seems like that'd be the next thing Paul talk about. And what do you know? It's the next thing Paul talks about. And you say, well, what does it have to do with lust? Well, again, lust can drive people to get married that shouldn't be getting married. They're not ready for marriage. They're not right for each other, but they get married because of lust, because they want to legitimize what they are doing or what they want to do with a marriage license. Lust drives them to marry before they're able to handle marriage. Maybe lust drives them to marry somebody they didn't really even know in the first place, well enough to know whether they want to spend the rest of their life with them, but lust drove them into it. Or possibly lust made them have to get married. In all these cases, lust is behind the marriage in the first place, and if lust is behind the marriage, then you're not necessarily headed for divorce, but you're going to have to rebuild your marriage on something else, or you will wind up in divorce. In another scenario, it may be that the marriage begins well enough, but again, his lust or her lust for someone or something else drives the members of the marriage apart, and the feelings of love that and affection that brought them together in the first place wither away, and they'll find themselves seeking a divorce as well. As I said, again, this is a review, but it's all necessary review. Marriage is the first community. It's the foundation of civilization. It is the most successful and the most enduring of all God's institutions. It's been handed down intact through the human race for about 6,000 years. And again, if you're failing in marriage, and I don't mean to just be insulting tonight for the sake of being insulting, but you need to seriously look at this fact. If you're failing in marriage, you're failing at something at which millions have succeeded before you. Marriage wasn't invented as an experiment, you know, in your parents' lifetime, and we're still learning how to do it. They've been doing it for 6,000 years. And so when you consider that the majority of those who succeeded at marriage were not even saved, and they managed to succeed at marriage, and it's only been the last half century that divorce rates have risen so sharply, then we have to recognize that there's a real problem in the way we think about marriage, the way we approach our marriage vows and our marriage commitment to one another. Remember, God does say that he hates divorce in Malachi 2:16, I hate putting away. And since that's a very... God says he hates a thing, that's no light thing to consider. We want to take that subject very seriously. And I did say last time that he does allow for it. There are biblical grounds for the end of a marriage, and that's what a divorce is. If you're divorced, you don't have a marriage anymore. You're not half married or shadow married or kind of married. You're either married or you're not married. You know, again, here's a preacher and his wife leaves him and they get divorced, and somebody says, well, he can't pastor. Why? Because he's married, but he's divorced. You know, he got married, but he's divorced. And so he's not married. And then if he gets married again, he's been married, he's got two wives. I mean, that's the way some of them look at it. You know, he got remarried. Well, now can he pastor? No, because he's got two wives. Well, if he had, how does 0 + 1 make 2? Right? If he had no wife when he was divorced and he's got one wife after he's remarried. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I'm just saying that kind of Pharisaical thinking is something that we have to consider. There are grounds for divorce, and one of them is fornication. Again, unrepented, gross, unrepented, continuing sexual infidelity is grounds for divorce. Desertion. And again, that's willful and permanent desertion of a believer by an unbeliever is grounds for divorce. We dealt with false professions also at the time. And so that kind of brings us up to the arguments or the main statements in the passage, propositions up to verse 24. And here they are so far. I just give you the 6 propositions. And if you want the proofs, get the tape, because if I do it all that again, obviously we'll be here as long as we were last week, and we'll never get moving out of this passage. We'll be reviewing forever. So here's the 6 things that we saw already. Number 1, all sexual touching outside of marriage is off limits. It says there, now concerning things whereof ye wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now let me read to you from the NIV, just so you can see what it says. Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry. Isn't that interesting? Does that sound anything like it's teaching anything close to what it says there in your King James Bible? It goes from it's good for a man not to touch a woman to it's good for a man not to marry. You hear that joke about the cannibal? He had a bellyache? Cannibal went to the witch doctor. And he said, Umguba have bellyache. And the witch doctor says, what Umguba eat? And he said, Umguba eat missionary. He said, what missionary look like? He said, short, fat, long brown robe, rope for belt, bald spot. How Umguba cook? He said, Umguba boil. He said, there's your problem. Him not boiler, him fryer. Well, that's not Bible. I mean, that Catholic. It's good for a man. Now, the Bible says nothing of the kind. Now, we'll get some other verses that may seem to say that, but that is a blank, a misstatement of the intent of the verse altogether. All sexual touching outside of marriage is off limits. Secondly, sexual relations are not only acceptable in marriage, they're an obligation. And they should be a delight. Thirdly, separation is not a way to reconcile a marriage. I did say there are grounds for separation. Any reasonable person. I would not send a woman back into the home where the husband was going to knock her around and she's going to lose teeth on a regular basis. That's not grounds for divorce. But it is grounds for separation. But again, sometimes people separate when they don't have reason to do that. And you can't put people back together by getting them apart. Number 4. I don't want to get back too deep in all the things I've already said, but marriage can be an obstruction to certain kinds of Christian service. But there are worse obstructions to Christian service than marriage. And that's right there in verse number 6 and 7 and 8. I would that all men were of myself, every man have his proper gift of God, one of this man or another after that. I say therefore the unmarried widows is good for them if they abide, even as I, if they cannot contain, let them marry. So forth. Number 5, once you are married, you're expected to do everything in your power to make that marriage a success. And that's in chapter 7, verse 10 through 16. Again, if you want to check me out, go ahead. And number 5, the solution to your problems, this is verse 17 to 24, the solution to your problems is not a change in your circumstances, but a change in your attitude. And by the way, that's the case always. I mean, it doesn't really matter what it is. The solution to your problem is never a change in your circumstances. It's always a change in your attitude. It's true in marriage. It's true in everything. But some people might think, well, you know, that applies everywhere except for marriage. So God said it very clearly with regard to marriage too. Your problem is your attitude about what you have instead of what you have. And when you change your attitude about what you have, then what you have wouldn't seem nearly as bad as it is. Again, I wish I could explain it all with more detail, but we'll never finish the chapter if I do. So it is on tape. Now we come to some new material. If you look at verse number 25 there, and I'm probably just going to, again, I put it in the most sermonic form I can. It's more teaching than it is preaching tonight. But sometimes you need to just dig into some of the more difficult passages in the Bible and make sure that we understand them. That anything in the Bible is important, and I would think that this would be of immense importance. Even if it doesn't lend itself to, amen, that's good preaching. I mean, and I like good preaching, but sometimes you just got to dig into the raw material here and get the facts whether they preach good or not. Now, the next proposition is kind of closely related to the one before. It's not the same, but it's similar. Verse 25 to 26 there. Let's read them. Now, concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment as one that obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. By the way, this is great in the NIV too. I don't always do this, but he says, now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. No, that's not at all what it says. Not trustworthy, but obtain mercy of the Lord to be faithful. You understand, Paul justifies his right to give the advice in the humblest way possible. I mean, he goes to great lengths. He obviously wasn't an independent fundamental Baptist because he goes to the greatest lengths possible to take all credit off of himself and put it on the Lord. So I give my judgment as what? As one that had obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. Are you faithful? Are you? How'd you get that way? You obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. You know, and look at me, I am a faithful man of God. I'm a great man. No, it's, you know, the only way I can even dare say this is because I obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. Somehow, God was really merciful to me, and I got to be faithful when sometimes other people aren't. That's Paul's attitude about himself. And I think everybody wants to, can be faithful, but he does not take the high horse. He takes the low seat. Just God working in me, that's all. Again, let me give you a summation of these two things. Learning to have contentment in your present situation is your main responsibility. Concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment. Okay, what is it? Is one of the obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful? I suppose, therefore, that this is good for the present distress. I say that it is good for a man so to be. Art thou bound unto a wife? Seek not a wife, or seek not to be loose. Art thou loose from a wife? Seek not a wife. But if thou marry, thou hast not sinned, so forth. The point here is this. Let's take these things as they come up. Number one, the word virgin. In verse 25, concerning virgins, I have no commandment. Now, you know what that is. As far as the word virgin goes, it's translated, the word parthenos, Greek word parthenos, is a feminine noun. So some commentators have assumed that because that's a feminine noun, that it's only talking about young ladies. But it would be very strange to advise young ladies not to marry and then encourage young boys to marry, because who are the young boys going to marry if the young ladies are advised not to? And by the way, in Revelation 14, verse number 4, that word parthenos refers to those 144,000 virgins, which are all males, by the way. So it's not exclusive. Now, Paul is speaking from experience here because he was unmarried. Peter was married because he had a mother-in-law. Right? His wife's mother was sick. And again, who in the world would want a mother-in-law and not have a wife? That's a crazy man. But he had both. And so what he's saying there, he said, you know, I've been here. I understand what it's like to remain single and morally intact. You don't have to take his advice, and you may not even want to give him a hearing. But again, I wouldn't want to ignore the Apostle Paul on any subject. And he says, so, you know, you might want to listen to what I have to say, because I've kind of lived according to this myself. In verse 26, I suppose, therefore, that this is good for the present distress. I say that it's good for a man so to be. You might want to look back in verse 8, where he says, I say therefore the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. Now, what's this present distress? That's where we got, you know, again, we have to really teach this. Preaching is not going to happen very well. Look at verse number 29. Paul says there, but I say, brethren, the time is short. It remaineth that both they have wives be as though they had none, and they that weep as though they wept not. And we'll have to deal with that when we get to it also. But evidently, there was some temporary condition in Paul's time when he writes 1 Corinthians. There's something going on in the world that made celibacy advisable for that period of time. It was an advisable thing. It was a good thing. It was a recommended thing. Paul recommended it at that time for the present distress. And after that present distress was over, the advice would no longer apply. They say, what is the present distress? What exactly is the nature of that difficulty or that necessity that Paul said it's good for us to who are single to remain single? Well, honestly, we can only guess at it. I think it's some impending persecution. I thought that myself for a long time. They weren't really under severe persecution at the time, but there were threats of persecution. That's one interpretation. The other one is this. Now imagine Paul being married and having children and going on the kinds of missionary journeys that he went on. You ever read 2 Corinthians 11? About all the shipwrecks and whippings and all that sort of thing? You want to take a wife and kids into a city where you're likely to get stoned? You want to take your wife and kids in a place, you know, where they're going to whip you in public, drag you out of the city for dead, and leave you outside in the sand? That's no place for a wife and kids, folks. You say, well, what's Paul saying? Imagine Paul being married with children and trying to carry out the kind of ministry we know that he had where he was in physical danger almost all the time. Now, you understand, some people have ministries where they can expect persecution. They can expect opposition. They can expect extreme physical hardship, you know, and it might be a good thing for those. I'm sure it would be a good thing for those folks to remain single. I can't imagine dragging a family along with Paul and all of his companions. Now, that could be a temporary thing. Because, you know, now Paul carried it on until old age, but, you know, some guys might be able to do that until they're about 30, 35. You know, Brother Gibbs said this week, I don't even know if I agree with him, but he said it to me personally. He said, I think all the people who do the soul winning in your church really ought to be the young men. You know, and we did it. I mean, those of us that are in our 40s and 50s, we were saying, that's, you know when I did my greatest amount and had my greatest effectiveness as a soul winner? When I was in my 20s. I wasn't a mall rat. You know, trying to dress cool and attract, you know, I was preaching on street corners. I was going on, I'd get four or five guys in a car and we'd head off Montgomery, Alabama, or we'd head off for some other city in Atlanta, Georgia, or Charlotte, North Carolina. And we go street preaching. Just get a box full of tracks and an old rickety car. We'd drive 5-6 hours in one direction in a car that didn't have reverse. You say, didn't you know that the transmission might not get you home? We didn't care. You know, because really, I mean, 5-6 guys in their 20s, we'll get home. Understand? But I'm not taking my wife and kids on that kind of a crazy expedition now. We don't go anywhere unless I got a car that I can be sure, I'm darn sure that car's going to make it where I point it. And back. Say what? I'm past the age of driving old, rickety, beat-up cars, you know, with exhaust hung up but when I was 20, that was fine. And when I was 20, that's when I did all that street preaching and all that passing out tracts and all going to New Orleans for the Mardi Gras and all that kind of, that's when you do that. And that's what you should be doing. So boy, the Christian life is boring. You're boring. You're a gutless bore. You're a worldly bore. That's what you are. If you had any guts and you had any God in you, you'd get involved in street preaching and going on mission trips and that sort of thing. While you still were young, you didn't have the responsibilities of the family. Boring. No, you're boring. There wasn't anything boring at all about some of those expeditions that we took. They were exciting to the last minute. We get home 3-4 o'clock in the morning, man, just all buzzed up. Because why? We were living on the edge with the gospel for Jesus' sake. See, now I say, well, you're backslid. No, I'm married. And I've got children. You say, well, you know, you're married, care for the things of the world, how we may please his wife. Yep. And I wouldn't be in the ministry if I didn't have one. Really. I would not, no way I would have made it this far if I didn't have a wife. I mean a godly one too. You see, it could be that what Paul's talking about, the present distress, you know, there might be a time in your life while you're still young enough to do some crazy, risky, on the edge, mission type evangelistic work. And that's the time to do it, while you're still young enough to do it. And then when you're past that age, maybe that's the time you want to get married. That doesn't, I'm not saying everybody should wait until they're 30 or 35. I'm just saying that's maybe what Paul is referring to. And Paul never got over it. I ain't put together like him, but he never got over it. Let me go on to the next thought. And again, some of these may not seem that related, but they all apply to our broad subject, and that is marriage and sanctity in marriage and all that. Verse 27 says, "Art thou bound to a wife? Seek not to be loosed." That's pretty clear. He's already said that, kind of, anyway. "Art thou loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife. But and if thou marry, thou hast not sinned." Again, I think that's self-explanatory, isn't it? And again, how are you loosed from a wife? Death, desertion, or fornication, right? You had a wife, now you're loosed from a wife. You're legitimately loosed by death, desertion, or fornication. Present time, don't be looking for a wife, but and if thou marry, God puts somebody in your life that you decide would be right, and they got it for you, and you got it for them, and before the Lord, in the Lord, you guys want to get together. It's not a sin to do that. And if a virgin marries, she hath not sinned. A virgin girl could marry a guy who'd been married previously before. That's not something I recommend. But it's not sin if you do it. But here, watch this. Why don't I recommend it? "Nevertheless, such shall have trouble in the flesh. But I spare you." I'm not going to spare you. Paul spared you, but I'm not going to spare. I'm going to say a little bit about it. I'm not going to say everything I could have about it. First part of verse number 28 must have something to do with non-virgins, because the second part, after the colon there, or semicolon, has to do with virgins. And it says basically the same thing about virgins after the semicolon as it does before the semicolon. And if you look at verse number 27 again, it might be it's probably previously married non-virgins that are in view in verse 27, the early part of verse number 28. End of verse number 28, it's never been married, never ever had any sexual activity. If a virgin marries, she hath not sinned. What's the point here? The point is this: sex before marriage leads to trouble after marriage. What is the trouble in the flesh? "Such shall have trouble in the flesh, but I spare you." I think the trouble in the flesh might be called ghosts in the bedroom. Because those who have been involved in sexual sin before marriage have a greater susceptibility to infidelity after marriage. They just do. Again, I don't preach against dating and preach on courtship just because I'm a great big killjoy and want to spoil all your fun. If you can get to the marriage altar wearing white and not being a hypocrite and kiss for the first time that person that you stand at that altar with and take those vows with, you will be much less susceptible to the temptation of marital infidelity than those who engage in sex before marriage. I don't care if it's only the same person. If it's even the same person that you marry and that's the only person you fool around with outside of marriage is the one you wind up with, you will have greater temptation to sexual infidelity than somebody who was pure when they got to the altar. That, I think, is the trouble in the flesh. Again, the ideal joining together, folks, is virgin to virgin. You understand? If you've got a virgin to virgin joining together, you have hopefully done the greatest possible thing to preempt any such trouble in the flesh, as Paul mentions there. Now, it's possible that two virgins could go to the altar, get married, and still have infidelity in their marriage. It's not a guarantee, but it's the best way that you can go about trying to prevent it from happening. Do you want to be, let me ask, do you want to practice infidelity after you're married? Anybody in here say, "After I'm married, I plan on cheating on my spouse"? Anybody, you want your spouse to cheat on you? Okay, well then, the best way that you can go about that then is to follow the instructions in chapter 7 and verse number 1. Not to not marry, like the NIV says, but all sexual touching outside of marriage is sin. It's all sin. And if thou marry, it's not a sin to marry. It's not a sin for a virgin to marry somebody that's been involved in, even in a marriage previously, and divorced. It's not a sin. It's not a sin to do it. But nevertheless, such shall have trouble in the flesh. Ghosts in the bedroom. Not just the temptation of infidelity, but the prospect of comparison. And even if nobody's comparing anybody to anybody in the past, the one who maybe was clean, pure, is imagining that the person who wasn't pure is comparing them to somebody else. And even if the person who wasn't pure doesn't compare, the person who was pure wonders if the one who wasn't pure is comparing them to somebody in the past. Trouble. Trouble. Say, now, can it work? Yes, it can work. Is it possible they can have a happy marriage? It's possible they can have a happy marriage. But there'll be more trouble, more cause for trouble, more occasion for trouble in the marriage. And that's why I recommend everybody stay pure until you get there. Say, well, I love so-and-so. Well, okay, maybe you do. Maybe you could even marry him. It wouldn't be a sin to marry him. Are you willing to put up with the additional baggage that that marriage is going to have? Fine. Accept it. Go into it knowing what it is you're going to be up against. Calculate it in, and just, you know, whatever the possible pleasure points you're going to get out of marriage, knock a few off, and you'll, you know, just say, I don't know what percentage I'm going to be able to knock off or have to knock off, but knock a few off and say it's still worth it to me. Go ahead. But don't be foolish enough to assume that it's going to be the same as it would have been if you had two virgins at the altar. I'm going to say a virgin can't marry a non-virgin, or a non-virgin can't marry a virgin. Such will have trouble in the flesh, though. There's going to be envy, there's going to be jealousy, there's going to be questions, and there's going to be greater temptation to infidelity. Sex before marriage leads to trouble after marriage. Even if that sex was legitimate in another marriage. You have two virgins get married, they break up, they divorce, they separate, and they remarry somebody else, even though everything they did in that marriage was legitimate and right, and they never had any sexual contact with anybody outside of that marriage. Now, that marriage is broken off, and they go into another marriage, they're still bringing stuff with them, because they've still been involved in sexual relations with somebody else before. Even if it was legit, they still got that with them. Now, again, some people they just do fine with that. They manage. They have happy marriages. They go on. They do all right. But that's because they got something other than sex holding them together. But it doesn't mean there's no issues they ever have to, nothing they ever have to pray about, nothing they have to put out of their minds, nothing they have to just say, I accept that, I don't like it, but it's the facts of my marriage, and in order to have a happy one, I'm going to have to just deal with that. Number 8. Verse number 29. This I say, brethren, the time is short. It remaineth that both that they that have wives be as though they had none. Now again, what is that all, what is Paul talking about? Let me give you a summation of what I think he's saying, and then I'll explain my summation. Sometimes there are circumstances in which it may be advisable not to marry. Again, this is kind of related to what we saw in verse number 25 and 26 too. Now, what is the short time? The time is short, he says there. Not the time is short. What short time is Paul talking about? Is it a short time between when Paul's talking and the second coming? Again, if he's saying it, it's only a short time between now and the second coming, no purpose in getting married, well, there wouldn't be any Christian homes, would there? Because the Lord hadn't come yet, and everybody in Paul's day would have died off, and everybody since him, if they'd have done what they were supposed to do and not get married because the Lord's coming was in a short time, there wouldn't be any Christian homes. I think the Christian home is part of our witness to the world. Christian husbands, Christian wives, raising Christian children for the glory and the service of God is part of our testimony and our witness to the world. So it can't be a short time until the Lord's return. And it can't be the time of our lives. You're going to be dead, and here you are 20, and you're going to be dead in 50 years, so there's no point in getting married now. So what's the short time? I believe the short time that Paul's referring to is until that present distress really hits them with everything it's got. It's building up. I'll read you what Charles Hodge said about it. Charles Hodge said, the ancient prophets searched diligently into the meaning of their own predictions. You know, 1 Peter 1, 10 to 12, searching what or what time, the manner or what manner the Spirit speaking in them did prophesy and so forth. And the apostles knew little of the times and the seasons. Acts 1, 7, the angel said, it's not for you to know the times or the seasons. Just get out here, get filled with the Holy Spirit, and get out there winning people to Christ. Don't worry about times and seasons. They wanted to have a prophecy conference, and the Holy Spirit, the angel, told them, have a soul winning conference. They knew the great calamity. Here's what Hodge goes on. They knew that great calamities were to come on the earth. But how or when, it was not given them to clearly see. The awful desolation which was soon to fall on Jerusalem and on the whole Jewish race, and which could not but involve more or less the Christians also, and the inevitable struggles and persecutions which, according to our Lord's predictions, his followers were to encounter, were surely enough to create a deep impression on the apostle's mind and to make him solicitous to prepare his brethren for the coming storm. It was not, however, the calamities which are to precede the second advent to which Paul refers here, but rather to those which it was predicted should attend the introduction of the gospel. So Hodge is clear. He understands it to mean that when the missionaries began to take the gospel around the world, there was going to be a persecution against the church. And that persecution was soon to begin under Nero. At the time that Paul writes 1 Corinthians, he is not yet in prison, but he winds up in prison pretty quickly. And he's imprisoned by Nero. Not the first time, but the second, and then he's released. You know, when he writes Philippians, Colossians, and Ephesians, he's been recaptured. He's back in prison. Then he's in the Mamertine prison. He has two imprisonments. An early one, then he's released, may even go to Spain during the time he's released, and then he's captured, and then he's put in a bad situation. But again, if 1 Corinthians, anybody got a date on 1 Corinthians? 66, 67 AD, right? Somewhere in there? Pardon me? 59 AD? Anybody got a date for Philippians? Okay, you got 5 years. 5 years between when Paul writes this book and when he winds up in the Mamertine prison. You understand? It's brewing. You can see a storm coming, right? You know it's on the horizon. It's not there yet. The lightning isn't striking. You can't hear the thunder. You're not getting hit by the rain, but you can see there's a storm a-coming. Usually comes out of the west, right? You understand? This isn't the first time the Bible said anything like this. Don't you remember back in Deuteronomy where it says, when a man hath taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business, but he shall be free at home 1 year and shall cheer up his wife which he hath taken? That always kind of tickled me. It takes 12 months of nothing but constant attention to cheer up a woman after she's had to marry most guys. That's a sad thing. But you're not supposed to go off to war. Why? Because you're taking a wife. Remember in that one parable, you know, where they got all the excuses about why they can't come to marriage ceremony. Well, I bought a piece of land. I have to go look at it. Why would you buy a piece of land and not look at it first? Oh, I bought a couple of yoke and oxen. I got to take them out and see if they'll plow. Why would you buy a tractor and not know it ran? You know, I'm going to see if the tractor I just bought runs. Oh, that's a good one. And the third one says, I've taken a wife. He had an excuse. But you understand? So, what is it that he's saying here in verse number 29 then? Brethren, the time is short. It remains that both they that have wives be as though they had none. Does that mean all the married men are supposed to leave their wife? Folks, that is not instruction for men to neglect their wives. The Bible never instructs us to neglect our responsibilities to others. You know what that is? That's an instruction to husbands, not concerning their duties, it's concerning their expectations. If you know the general tone of the Bible, if you know what the Bible says about most everything, it says don't have any expectations of anybody else for you. Fulfill your duties to others, but don't expect anything in return. That's called Christianity, by the way. Again, you know, while I do believe in skirt lengths and haircuts and all that sort of thing, that has very little to do with Christianity. Christianity has a whole lot more to do with things like fulfilling your duties and not having any expectations than it has to do with being a selfish, prideful, thumb-sucking, overgrown baby and wanting everything to go your way and carrying a big fat Bible and having all your external ducks in a row. That's not Christianity. That's Phariseeism, but it's not Christianity. You know, so let those that have wives be as though they had. In other words, quit having high expectations from your wife because things are going to get rough. When things get rough, you do your job, you fulfill your responsibilities, but don't expect anything in return. Tough it out. Again, if every man in the world would take that advice and have no expectations from their wives, they'd have a lot happier marriages. Because they'd be happy with what they had instead of complaining about what they didn't. Again, you can't understand verse number 29, absent of Ephesians chapter 5, where it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it by the washing of the water of the word, that he might present to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing. You can't say, well, this verse here, verse number 29, cancels out Ephesians 5. No. In military parlance, the last orders always take priority over previous orders. Ephesians comes after 1 Corinthians. Ephesians, Paul is in the prison. In Corinthians, he's saying, you might want to stay single and you might want to lower your expectations and get down to the business of doing your duties and quit expecting anything from anybody else because it's going to get rough. And by the time we're in Ephesians, it's gotten rough. And Paul tells husbands to love their wives like Christ loved the church. So there's no excuse here for leaving your wife in verse number 29. They that have wives be as though they had none. None whatsoever. We're to nourish and cherish our wives. What it is, there's the demand of sacrificial care and maintenance of other people, but not for yourselves. It's not neglecting the wife in marriage. It's not getting out of the marriage. It's not ending the marriage that Paul has in view. It's lowering your expectations from marriage when things get rough. Now, verse number 30, here's another proposition. And they that weep as though they wept not, they that rejoice as though they rejoiced not. Again, let me ask you, making a comparison between those that have wives as though they had none. Let me ask you, you get whacked on the bridge of the nose with a baseball bat, are you going to cry? I mean, you either did or did not get hit on the bridge of your nose with a baseball bat. And the fact of the matter is, most of us will cry. Right? My dog is dying. I got a dog. I like that dog. I love that dog. That dog loves my wife and daughters more than any animal we've ever had in our house. And I mean, that dog would not hesitate to die for any of them. He'd take a bullet. He'd take anything for any of my girls. And he's got kidney failure, and he's got arthritis in his hips, and he's dying. He's dying pretty quick. I don't know if he'll make it through the week. I don't know. But he's a good dog. He's a faithful, devoted dog. I love that dog. I'll cry. And say, now what are you going to do about it? The Bible says those that weep be as though they wept not. You know what? I'm going to cry about losing that dog, and I'm going to go about my business. I was brokenhearted about that dog when I got up and preached this morning. And I can get up and, so I just can't preach. My dog's dying. Right? Yeah, my dog's dying. I love the dog, and it hurts. It really hurts. I curled up next to him and cried for 20 minutes the other night. I love that dog. Now I'm crying. I'm messing me up. But you know what I mean? I got it. You know what? I still got a life to live. I still got responsibilities. I still got duties. And a dying dog can't prevent me from doing what I got to do as a husband and as a father and as a pastor and everything else. Stop cutting the grass and go into a blue funk and let weeds grow all over the yard because I got a dying dog. You know, we sorrow not even as others which have no hope. You got things in your life that make you happy, you want to celebrate? Celebrate them. You got things in your life that are going to make you sad, they're going to make you cry, they're going to break your heart? Have a broken heart, but live your life responsibly. Don't let it throw you so off balance that you can't effectively serve God. If tribulations can't stop you from serving God, Marriage shouldn't stop you from serving God, and sorrow shouldn't stop you from serving God, and even being happy shouldn't stop you from serving God. I've seen people stop serving God because they were happy. I told men last night, the couple guys I prayed with, when we got done praying, I said, now, you know, I said, I think things are going to start happening. And the one thing I don't want to happen is that we stop praying because things start happening. Because that's kind of what, you know, things are going good, so we can quit. So we know we need God, so we start getting some men faithfully coming to the prayer meeting. Again, 15 were here last night, and some were here that had never been here before, and others that have been here before recently weren't here. And, you know, and so probably got everybody together. Maybe it's come. We'd probably be averaging about 20. Say, well, you know, we had a good prayer meeting once. I went to one and haven't gone since because it was so good. You know, I don't feel like I need to go to any more. You know, somebody, there's a lot of guys going. So, no, you know, every man ought to come occasionally. Every one of you ought to come occasionally, and some of us ought to be there all the time. But the point is, you know, you cannot treat verse number 29 in the way some people want to treat it and make any sense at all by comparison to verse number 30. They that have wives as though they had none. You can't just say, well, I got a wife, but I really don't have a wife anymore, and I can say my heart's broken, but it's really not broken. No, my heart is broken, but I will function as though it wasn't. My heart is elated, but I will function as though it wasn't. I won't let my elation distract me. I'm under persecution, but I will function as though I wasn't. I will not let persecution distract me from my goal. That's what Paul is getting at here. We remain, that's summarized in this statement, we are to remain unaffected by the circumstances that cause most people to get off track in their duties. You see, the fashions of this world are so short-lived, why should we be ruled by them at all? They that weep as though they wept not, those that rejoice as though they rejoice not, those that buy as though they possess not. And they that use this world is not abusing it. For the fashion of this world passeth away. You know, why is it that we're so consumed with conforming to the fashions of the world when the world's going to change them next year? They're going to change them next season. How many of you saw that article, and it was on WorldNet Daily, and it got out some other places after that, but that 11-year-old girl that wrote to, was it Lord & Taylor or Nordstrom's, said, how come you want dresses like sluts, is what she said. Can't find anything decent in the store. And the person who got the letter wrote her back and said, you know, you're right about that. I looked through our inventory and I couldn't find one thing that a girl that wanted to look modest could wear. But get ready, this fall, you know, we're going to have I wish it was Walmart instead of Nordstrom's, you know. So we're going to have a line of you know, modest and decent, wholesome girl next door looking clothes. We'll see it. I'll believe it when I do. I sure wish it was Walmart instead of Nordstrom. But you know, we're slaves to fashion, aren't we? And Paul says, don't be. Those that use this world is not abusing it. Again, we're not Amish people. I have respect for Amish people, but I don't want to be one. And I don't think they're right, by the way. I can respect them because they really tough it out. I think it's unnecessary for them to tough it out like they do. And Gibbs said, you know, you're not really having a baby unless you have it in a log cabin with an Amish, in a dirt floor, an Amish midwife, you know. That whole going back to nature thing, I really don't believe that is a proper expression of biblical Christianity today. I think we can use this world, just not abuse it. And it's an abuse of this world when we're too consumed by its fashions. That's where I get my definition for worldliness. I say worldliness, it's in bullfighting britches, you know. Worldliness, it's that country western music. Worldliness is a slavish and subservient attitude towards the likes and the dislikes and the fads and the fashions of a Christ-rejecting culture. Whatever they produce, we got to have it. We got to be the first in line. We got to be right there with everybody else. We don't want to be the last one to see the movie or read the book or get the style. You understand? We got to have it just as fast as everybody else does. We got to be there in the front of the line. That's worldliness. Now, you can use the world. Just don't abuse it. The world might produce something worth using. If it does, get one. Just don't knock people out of the way to get in the front of the line so you can have one before everybody else, because now you're abusing it. Wait till the price goes down. Seriously. Wait till everybody else has one and there's a few left, and you know, now they're trying to get rid of the last few and it's worth having. Help yourself when it goes on sale. If you guys say, I don't care what it costs, I gotta have one, gotta have one. That's worldly. Using this world. I would have you to be without carefulness, he says in verse number 32. He that is unmarried cares for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. Let me just give you this. Number 10, verse 32 and 33 and 34, to be married means to have more responsibility than an unmarried person. Again, some of this is kind of repetitious, but Paul bothers to repeat these things. He says the same thing different ways, comes at it from different angle. Verse 32, Paul's advice was intended to make them as free from care as he possibly could. I would have you without carefulness. You know, that's kind of the, really, believe it or not, that's the approach most pastors have, most preachers have when they get up here and start banging their gums. They're trying to make you as free from care as they possibly can. I'm not trying to complicate your life with a lot of things. I'm trying to get everything out of your life that will complicate it. I'm just trying to make you free from care as I possibly can. And he says, he is unmarried, care for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. So if you're not married, and it didn't say if you are married, try to get out of the marriage. But if you are married, stay in the marriage. Don't expect anything. Anything out of your husband, he can do whatever he does for you and do something for the Lord and you'll be happy. But if your attitude is, man, they got to do for me, I got to be number one to them, you'll never be happy. Yes, a married man can do less for his a saved married man can do less for his wife than an unsaved married man can do for his wife, because a saved married man is expected to serve God. But most saved women get more out of their saved husbands that serve God than lost women get out of their lost husbands that don't serve God. Did I make that clear? Okay. Isn't it funny how we get, you know, we say, well, you know, if I marry a lost man, he'll devote himself entirely to me. No, he'll devote himself entirely to something besides you. If I get a saved, you know, Charles Keene's famous line, most women want saved husbands so they'll take out the garbage and not drink the paycheck. But anything beyond that, they're not interested in having a husband who goes on visitation on Thursday night, or a husband who comes out to prayer meeting on Saturday night, or a husband who works a bus route on Saturday. But I would venture to say, if a woman's got a husband who's dedicated enough to go on soul winning on Thursday, or Saturday, or prayer meeting on Saturday, or bus calling on or Saturday night, or bus calling on Saturday morning, they've got a husband that probably treats them better than most lost women treats their wives that don't have anything else to do on Thursday night, except for watch some stupid ball game. Or Saturday morning, except for go to the golf course. Or Saturday night, go have a few beers with the buddies. See, we get it all mixed. We think, you know, do you know God made time just like he made money? And he made it in such a way, if we give God what belongs to him, we'll do better with the remaining hours of the day. Just like we give God what belongs to him financially, we'll do better with the remaining hours of the day. And he made marriage. And he made marriage in such a way so that if we give ourselves to God and serve God and don't have any expectations from our spouse, we'll be more fulfilled serving God as a couple, both of us serving God and having no expectations from our spouse. We'll get more out of our spouse and more enjoyment out of being married than the people who put God on the shelf so that they can devote themselves to their marriage. Selfish yuppies is all they are. And the more they try to do for one another, the more they try to have a happy, successful, fulfilled marriage with all the big vacations and the condo and all the trips and all the cruises and all that sort of stuff, the less fulfilled and the more empty they are.
Now, to be married means to have more responsibility than an unmarried person, but with responsibility comes privilege. He that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. We don't want to be caught up in that attitude. We have to take care of our spouses, but we don't want to be caught up in an attitude where we are demanding of our spouse. Responsibility comes privilege. Okay, I got a wife, I have responsibilities, but I get privileges because I have a wife. My privileges are to leave things all over the house and never pick them up, right? Those are my privileges are, you know, to leave a bathtub ring around the tub, you know, that was, you know, 3 inches thick, a scummy foam and grease. And no, those aren't my privileges. But I do have the privileges. I got a license to kiss her. I want to kiss her anytime I want to, right? Anytime I want to. Why? Because I got a license to. I'm not supposed to touch anybody else, but I can kiss her anytime. I got a license. That's privilege. I'm going to pay for the responsibility, or pay for the privilege with responsibility. And if you get married, yes, assume that you're going to have responsibilities as a result of it. I would have you without carefulness. He that is unmarried, care for the things that belong to the Lord, have him may please the Lord. He that is married, care for the things of the world, have him may please his wife. Then verse 34, there's a difference between a wife and a virgin. I sure hope so. If there's not, somebody's in trouble. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy, both in body and in spirit. But she that is married careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. Now that brings us to verse 35. And this I speak for your own profit. Not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, and that you may attend upon the Lord without distraction. You ought to divide that verse up into its statements. Number 11, 11th proposition out of the chapter. If you're willing to follow these principles, you will be better off for it. You can do whatever you want to. I'm just telling you what I think will help you. This I speak for your own profit. There's a pretty good model for pastors. And by the way, nobody pays attention to preaching anyway. I mean, they listen, but they really. I've just come to, I preach and preach and preach, and sometimes people do it, sometimes people don't, but I don't have any delusions about how people follow through with preaching. Very rarely is anything ever really done, every once in a while. But for the most part, you just talk, and on the rare occasion, one person really takes something home and lives it, and the rest of the time, you just waste your breath. But once in a while, something gets through, and so it's for that once in a while that you hope for, you know? But here's what Paul said. He said in verse number 35 there, I speak this for your own profit. Do what you want to. You'll profit if you listen to what I'm saying, he says. Not that I may cast a snare upon you. Isn't that an interesting statement? I know I'm all over the map tonight, but I'm just following Paul's example. He's all over the map. But did you know, an animal that is caught in a snare is confined against his will. Now, we know the devil has snares, don't we? You know, we may deliver them that are taken captive by him out of the snare of the devil that are taken captive by him at his will. But evidently, preachers put snares on people too. They're not supposed to, but evidently they can, because Paul says that's not what I'm doing. I'm not speaking for my profit, I'm speaking for your profit, and I'm not trying to put a snare on you. An animal that is snared is confined against its will. And Paul did not desire to bring anybody into that state, held captive against his will. In other words, he didn't know all the stuff that we know today about pastoral authority. You know, right? I have veto power over your life, and if you disagree with me, you're out of the will of God, right? Whatever it is you want to do, it couldn't be the will of God unless I said so. No, Paul says you're free to do as you please. Now, you are free to do as you please, but that's not going to stop me from giving you advice. And that's not going to stop me from warning you that if you disregard good biblical advice, that you're probably going to be sorry that you disregarded it. But when it finally comes right down to it, I've got no snare to catch you with that the Bible gives me. The Bible does not give me a trap to put you in and confine you against your will. I caught him. You know, how do you do it? You lay traps around the church building for people to get caught in, and now they're bound to do your biddance, do obeisance to the preacher and obey his every word. How do you set those traps? You have to psychologically mess with them and play with their minds. You have to, spin the illusion and stand behind a curtain and pull the levers.
A great and powerful Oz.
That's how you do it. We don't want to mess with him. He's the great and powerful Oz. Whatever he says. That's for your profit. You don't want to do it? Fine. I'm not paying the price. You're the one paying the price. I'm not casting a snare for you. I'm not trying to catch you and hold you against your will. I'm trying to change your will for that which is comely. You know, the person who goes against what God says and does whatever they want to does not have an appealing life. That ye may attend upon the Lord without distraction. In other words, if you don't care about living for God, don't listen to anything I'm saying. But if you want to attend upon the Lord with distraction, you might want to listen to what I'm trying to tell you here. That's what I'm saying, but that's what Paul's saying too. Number 12, verse number 36. But if any man that think that he behaveth himself uncomely toward his virgin, if she pass the flower of her age, and need so require, let him do what he will, he sinneth not, let them marry. Now, there are two interpretations of this verse, and some of you are going to get a little mad at me about this, but it's all right. Dr. Ruttman does not have a commentary on 1 Corinthians. So you can't look it up in his commentary. See what he says? But I took notes in 1 Corinthians class. And here's what he says about it. Verse 36. But if any man, that would be a single man. If any man think that he behaveth himself uncomely toward his virgin, that's a single man courting a girl who's under strong temptation. If she pass the flower of her age, that is puberty, and need so require, that is, he's burning with lust, let him do what he will, he sinneth not, let them marry. Now, let me read you what the NIV says. If anyone thinks he's acting improperly towards the virgin he's engaged to, and if she's getting along in years and he feels he ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He's not sinning. They should get married. Now, folks, I don't believe either one of those interpretations is right. You say, well, why are you having Dr. Ruttman in November? I'm having Dr. Ruttman in November, not because I always agree with him about everything, but because I wouldn't have a King James Bible today, one for him. And neither would anybody else. And as long as he's alive, I want to say thank you. Amen. Sit and listen to him and get something out of what he's preaching and give him a good fat love offering and go put on student school bill when he gets home. But that does not mean I'm going to follow everything he teaches, because especially when it comes to stuff like this, I don't think he's real reliable. I'll tell you what John Marshall says about the verse. I mean that. You want to know? Let me tell you what John Marshall says about the verse and see which one makes more sense to you. If any man, that's dad, think that he behaveth himself uncomely toward his virgin, that is, he's been unnecessarily strict or restrictive concerning suitors. I don't think there is such a thing, by the way. I don't think you can be too strict or too selective or too restrictive. Watch the thing too closely, but maybe it's possible, theoretically possible, that a dad could be just a little bit too hard-nosed when it came to suitors. If she passed the flower of her age, that is, that's past the best time to be getting married, and need so require, that is, there's no suitor who really measures up. I mean that. I mean, and again, I'm not making this up. I'm not putting words in Brother Marshall's mouth. I got notes in the Bible that I took when he made these remarks. He said them right here. Now, you may not remember it, but I remember, because I kind of believe in all this parental oversight things. Maybe you didn't take notes. I did. I took notes on what he said. When he got to this verse, I said, I want to find out what he says about that verse, because that verse has troubled me for years. What in the world does it mean? I think he knows what it means. Need so require. That is, there's no suitor really up to par. And by the way, the need may be nothing more than the daughter's perceived need that it's time to get married. in order to remedy her unhappiness. She needs to get married. She wants to get married. She's miserable because she's not married. And there's nobody really, you know, up to your expectations as a dad. But, you know, there's a decent guy and you can stomach him. You know what you do? Let him do what he will, he sinneth not. Let them marry. That is, dad can allow his daughter, without sinning, he can allow his daughter to marry somebody that maybe isn't exactly what he had hoped for. In other words, you know, she's getting to be, 38, 39, somewhere in there. And all that's left is stupid, or meathead, or whatever you choose to call him. And you say, all right, honey, you can marry meathead. It's not a sin to do that. Whatever you wind up calling him. I have not had names for all of the interested parties, but I have had names for some of them. But the point is this, you can't always get what you want when you want it, and when the time is getting short on the clock, you might have to settle for less, and if you do, it's not sin. But you might do better if you waited. Look at verse number 37. Nevertheless, he that standeth steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but hath power over his own will, and hath so decreed in his heart that he will keep his virgin, doeth well. You know what that tells me? Nevertheless, he that standeth steadfast in his heart, that's still dad. Having no necessity, that is, there's no decent suitors available, so he holds his ground. Hath power over his own will. That is, he's not controlled by all the women in the house. You think I'm joking? I'm not joking. When you get all the women in the house ganging up on you, you'll find it's harder to resist than it sounds. Like I said, my daughter's going to hate me for this, but I am set up for one case of PMS a month, not three. I can handle one. Three of you come at me at once, or two of you come at me at once, and it's going to get ugly. So dad's in a bad mood. No, dad's not in a bad mood. But I am not going to put up with it. That's all. Sit down and shut up. Then everything's fine. So, hath power over his own will. Not going to cave in. And hath so decreed in his heart that he will keep his virgin. And that is, you know, I don't think any of these guys are right. I don't care if you are 38. He doeth well. It's not a sin to marry her off to meathead. But it's better if you wait, even though it seems like you waited maybe too long already. It's better to keep waiting. If all that's in the wings is meathead. It's time to just pray. But stand fast. In verse number 38, Paul's remarks here presuppose parental authority with respect to the issue of marriage of daughters and sons. Now, Paul never gets up and says parents are supposed to supervise marriage. But the way he explains the whole thing happening, it's obvious that he takes it for granted that parents are going to supervise courtship and marriage. Nevertheless, he standeth fast in his heart and so forth. So then, verse 38, he that giveth her in marriage doeth well, but he that giveth her not in marriage doeth better. Who would that be? It's not she that giveth her in marriage. It's he that giveth her in marriage. And the only he that could give her in marriage is dad, right? Who giveth this woman to be married to this man? And so in this case, you understand, if verse 39 reads, or verse 38 reads properly, there's no way that Dr. Ruckman or the NIV can be right about verse 36. It's dad. Dad says, I don't think I'm giving her to you. And again, how do you take care of that? Well, you let them live like hell and do everything they want to until they're 18 and say, now I'm going to make sure you marry the right person. It starts out when they're in the cradle, folks. It's when you start making those ties in the cradle. I'll give you an illustration. It's be all right. Amy's got to have a wisdom tooth yanked. Got to have all her wisdom tooth. And there's one that's kind of a touchy situation. if she gets it pulled, she's going to have a patch on her lip from here to here, and down into her chin is going to be without any sensation. Now, it might fix itself, but the nerve's going to be torn, and she won't have any sensation right in here. And it'll probably get all right. You know, it might heal, but it might not. And she might have a tingling sensation the rest of her life, just a tingle in there all the time. So you know what? I'd rather get in a razor fight with five guys in an alley than see her go through. And that's not that big of a thing. If it was on your leg or your arm, on your back, I'd say, go through it. But it's on your face. You know, I told her, I said, honey, when you kiss the man you marry, I want you to enjoy every bit of it. Really? I said, I want you to enjoy every bit of it. I said, she's fine. She's sitting in the dentist chair talking with him, and I'm over the corner just, you know. I mean, you know what? It's because I love her. And she's known that from the time she was little. And what I don't want her to think, if I get in trouble with some boy, my dad's going to kill me. You know, I want to think my dad loves me, and it'd hurt him, and I don't want to hurt my dad like that. That's what I want. That's her fault, and Krista too. Krista's not in the room. But that's I went there first thought to be, I don't want to hurt my dad like that. I couldn't bear the thought. And they know I love him. And she knows, if there's any way I could take that away from her, I'd take something 100 times worse myself in order to take that away from her. But I can't. Something she's going to have to go through, something I'm going to have to trust God through, but I'd far rather take 100 times worse punishment for myself. They know it. Sometimes I'm a jerk. Sometimes I spout off. Sometimes I yell at people and tell them shut up. But I can't, you know, when I feel like I'm being ganged up on, but they know I love them. And it's my responsibility to protect them from undesirables. And they know when I'm doing it, I'm not just being a jerk. I joke about 38, but they know if I'm saying, that's a bad boy, stay away from that boy, they know where it's coming from. It's come from that same heart. Paul's remarks here presuppose parental authority with respect to marriages of daughters and sons. It is your job, it is your duty, it is your responsibility, it is your sacred calling before God to make sure that your child does not marry somebody they shouldn't marry. And not only that, but verse number 39, Paul's remarks presuppose something else. The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth. But if her husband be dead, she's at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. That presupposes that marriage is until death. If her husband be dead, she's at liberty to marry who she will, only in the Lord. And again, this abominates living together, doesn't it? It abominates prenuptial agreements, trial marriages. It even abominates the threat of divorce in an argument. Well, if you don't change, if things don't get better around here, I'll just divorce you. Why don't we just get a divorce? This verse abominates the idea of divorce. The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth. But if her husband's dead, she's at liberty to be married. So, again, don't ever talk about divorce. Talk about murder. If you don't stop it, I'll kill you. Or I'll pray for God to kill you. No, I'm joking. It's just late. But you never use divorce as a threat. You're not allowed. God didn't allow you to do that. You're bound by the law as long as he's alive. Sometimes marriages end in divorce. But if you use divorce as a threat, the threat of divorce to get what you want in a marriage, you're ungodly. Number 16, even widows aren't permitted to marry unbelievers. She's at liberty to marry to whom she will, only in the Lord. And again, some of this stuff is pretty clear. It doesn't need a lot of comment. And then last, in verse number 40, number 17, 17 propositions I've gotten out of here. Most widows are happier unmarried than remarried. Verse 40, she is happier if she so abide, after my judgment. And I think also that I have the Spirit of God. So Paul's opinion was most widows would probably be happier unmarried than married or remarried. You say, well, why would a widow remarry then? Two reasons. Really, two reasons. Yes, one of them's funny. But it's still a reason. It's not a joke. The first one is she needs the money. That might be funny too, but that's not funny. You know what I mean. But why would a widow remarry if she'd probably be happier without a husband? Why would she remarry? Because she may need the money or she may need the help of a man in raising children, and that's the way she has to go. because she doesn't have, can't afford it otherwise. The other one is this: she feels sorry for a man who would be unhappy without her. Really? I mean, I've seen widows marry men. They didn't need to get remarried, but that guy sure did. And you know, I could talk about Dave Rowley for a while here, couldn't I? Everybody here knows Dave Rowley. That knows Dave Rowley knows Dave was complete. And you know what the greatness of Nancy Rowley was? I mean, really, the man can't even find his shoes, really, without her help, or couldn't without her help. And she never, ever ran the home. She did not run the home, nor did she ever give the impression that she ran the home. She just served him and made him look good. What a tremendous woman. I mean, really, what a giant of a Christian woman. What a great example for any Christian woman to follow. She could have run the show, and he wouldn't even known she was. But she never, ever usurped authority, never took it upon herself. She only served him and helped him and tried to make him look good. And he really was completely lost without her. Now, he's divorced that second wife and is planning on marrying a third time. You know, I guess that's kind of family news. Most of you know about that. He's down in West Virginia. He's got a woman down there he wants to marry. And, you know, I'll count the second one as a big mistake. If he gets divorces number three and marries again, then I'm going to worry about him. But I can understand why he got caught up, you know, in this the desperate need. And sometimes widows marry men because they're merciful. They'd be happier without them. They got their life insurance and they've got the house and all that stuff, you know, and they're fine. But they remarry because here's a man who needs the help of a woman. And doesn't even tell men what to do about this thing. Doesn't tell widowers what to do, just as widows. Because you know what the widower's going to do? He's going to look for a wife, right? The body's hardly cold, and he's like, well, who can I get to fix dinner? But the widow, he's going to cash in a life insurance policy, and then she's going to be thinking about where she can go to dinner and on vacation with her friends. And if she's going to remarry, she better do it in the Lord. Say, well, I can't afford to not be married. I got to have a man. Well, make sure you marry a man of God if you're going to do that. You know, but according to Paul's advice, you women would probably be better off. That's why there's more widows than there are widowers. God's merciful and he lets the women outlive the men. Because if there were a lot of widowers, all the widows would be getting chased down. And they finally cave in to all the pressure and say, oh, the poor thing, I got to take care of him. I'd be out happier without him. But I got to take care of him. I can't leave him in that condition. And so, well, I'm done. Again, how do you put an invitation or on that? I have no idea. But just a bunch of stuff that Paul said about marriage and the details related to it that, you know, again, you need to know. Need to be prepared for some of the questions that are going to come up. I think we've gotten justification for several things here tonight with regard to dating, courtship, parental involvement, all those kinds of things. I don't know anything else to do but pray. Lord, please bless the church tonight. Thank you, Lord, for these instructions from your word. And again, nothing life transforming in any one point in the message, Lord, or not one great thought driven home, but just a discussion of these things that you've given us here that we better hearken to. And if we ignore them, we do it at our own peril. They weren't given to make life difficult for us. They were made, they're given to us to relieve some of the care in our lives and that we might profit from it. Not to be snared, but that our lives might be comely and that we might attend upon the Lord without distraction. So Lord, these things are important whether they make a good sermon or not for their purpose. And we ask you, dear Lord, we might remember them and apply them and thank you for them in Jesus' name. Brother Pryor, bus meeting. And Mrs. Wojo is going to meet with the teen girls and then...